I want to talk to you about TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off manufactured suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One game could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for checking out the Paul Mercurio Show again. And if it's the first time, welcome. You've missed so much. This week, my very special guest is Kelly Carlin, daughter of George Carlin. Really cool, amazing woman. She has some fascinating stories about her dad and about her own life. She's currently working on a memoir of her dad, and also she has a one-woman show that she's coming out with about her dad, and just a really cool person in her own right. Amazing stories about growing up with her mom and dad, a pretty dysfunctional family at times, to say the least, and just a really cool window into George Carlin and what he was like off stage and what drove him to do what he did and be as great as he was. I think it's a very, very special conversation that you're not going to get to hear just anywhere. And check me out on the road doing stand-up. Very special engagement at Stand Up Live in Phoenix, Arizona, September 4th through the 7th. So please come on out. That's the weekend after Labor Day. Kick back and have some laughs with us. And follow me on Facebook and Twitter at Paul Mercurio. And as always, spread the word about the podcast. People appreciate you tuning in.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. This week, I have on a very special guest, Kelly Carlin, the daughter of George Carlin, and just a human being in her own right. Welcome to the show.
I have two arms and two legs in my
exactly.
own right. It's an amazing thing.
Exactly. You're not just a piece of meat, so I hear. So Kelly is the host of her own show on Raw Dog, which can be heard at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and also, again, can be heard on Carlin's Corner on Channel 600 on Sirius XM as well. It's part of the 24/7 Carlin channel on Sirius XM. You should listen to it. It's a really cool channel dedicated to her dad, George Carlin. And actually, you have coming up on your show Fred Willard, which I'm jealous, and I'm a big Fred Willard fan, and you must be excited about that.
It was the best conversation. I recorded it last week, and I've met some cool people, but I have such a fondness for him. And in doing the research for the interview, I watched like four or five Fernwood Tonight episodes,
right,
which are still as brilliant as they were then. And
yeah.
And Fred, you know, has done everything, you know, all the Christopher Guests and everything like that. But and Modern Family and blah, blah, blah. But oh, my God, what a charming man and funny and understated and really genius. I don't think he even knows how genius he is.
Well, he's the kind of guy like you literally you can watch him read a menu and laugh.
Yes!
Just he steals every scene in Anchorman, in my opinion.
Yes.
And when he's on the phone and he's dealing with his kid doing these things. And yes, I think it is unusual that he's, you know, bombing children with his pants down. But, you know, just so dry. And there's really nobody else like him. And is he doing okay? I know he had some issues and that kind of created a bump in the road. But is he okay now?
He looks great. He looks healthy and energetic. And he's doing great.
How did he get started in comedy? Just for a second. I know I want to talk about a lot of things, but I'm fascinated.
He was part of a comedy duo. Which I did not know. I mean, this is why you do research. But he was part of a comedy duo for years and years. And then they broke up and he went off to Chicago to do Second City. And he didn't really know if he wanted to do it or not. But he auditioned with Robert Klein and blew everyone in the room away. And that was kind of the beginning for him. And so he did Second City for a while, and then if you look at his IMDb page, I mean, he's got hundreds of credits. The man has worked every single year for the last 50 years.
He opened for Moses, I think.
I think he did. He did the pre-parting of the Red Sea.
Yeah, exactly.
he warmed up the Red Sea.
Moses was big. He was like your dad in his day. He had a private cart. He didn't have a private jet, but he had a private cart that he would... let's get to you. I mean, you've had a one-person show, and you're writing a memoir based on that about... growing up being George Carlin's daughter, and talk a little bit about that and what prompted you to do the show and what the impetus was for that.
Yeah, the show started in a really kind of unique way. I had done a one-woman show in 2000.
People should know you're not a stand-up.
Not a stand-up,
probably
no.
Wondering, well, you know, George Carlin's daughter, do you do stand-up?
Yeah, never did stand-up. Never really had... a real motivation to do it. I mean, I think it's a great art form, and I know I wanted to stand up in front of people and talk about things, but the pressure to make people laugh
also for you, would it be an added pressure because you're George Carlin's daughter?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of having to live up to that.
Of course. And my dad pretty explicitly, you know, said that to me one day. He's like, I really want to discourage you from going that direction. I mean, the life is really difficult and on the road and and all of that. And then, you know, you don't want to be on stage with hecklers, you know?
And
he was being a real protective daddy, which was sweet. But I became a storyteller in the late 90s and around 2000. And so I did a one woman show then. So I was, Spalding Gray was a big hero of mine. So that's who I wanted to be. If not, basically Lorraine Newman. Those are my two stretches.
Oh, is that
like
right?
Sketch comedy or monologist. And still today I love doing both. I mean, I do both of them. So
you must have got to meet Lorraine because your dad, you know, hosted the first SNL and was part of that inner circle there.
I was young. See, that's the thing. People think like, oh, you were hanging out with all these comedy people and you were going everywhere with your dad. And during the summertime, my mom and I would go on the road with dad. But I did not meet Lorraine actually until after my dad died. I knew only a couple of comedians before my dad died. Now I know 300.
Yeah.
They came into my life and raised me up and said, you know, your family and come be in our tribe now, which was very, very sweet. But and that's how my show started, actually, because I became friends with Lewis Black. And
oh, he's a good friend of mine.
He's a doll and has become a dear friend of mine. And he's more my friend than yours, Paul. Okay, whatever.
How did you come to know Lewis?
So I invited him to my dad's memorial because the day after my dad died, I saw him on Larry King and heard what an influence my dad had had, and that my dad had actually called him and left a message on his answering machine. And so I invited we had a very small memorial. So I invited a couple of comedians to the memorial, him and Bill Maher and Rick Overton. And so Lewis and I became very close.
I like Rick. I had Rick on my show. He's great.
Rick's a doll. He's like a brother. He's become a brother to me. And so I don't know if you remember, but about 4 years ago or 3 years ago, Lewis did that comedy cruise. So the very first one he did, and he was out here in LA doing one of his shows, and my husband Bob and I went to see him, and we were hanging out backstage, and he leaned over to me and he said, I want you guys to come on the boat with me. And I'm like, okay, that sounds like way too much fun. And he says,
or like a creepy cult.
Yeah, so yeah, pretty much the creepy comedy cruise ship cult. And He says, so I need a day event. So he says, come on board. There's going to be 400, you know, fans of mine, which means they're 400 fans of your dad's. Mm-hmm. So come on, play some videos and tell some of your great stories that you tell, you know, because I've been telling stories for 10 years. And I'm like, wow, that sounds like fun and all of that. And we get a 7-day cruise in the Caribbean with Lewis Black and seven of his best friends. Sign me up.
Yeah.
So we did. And the morning of the event, I think it was like day two. So our livers were still intact by this point. I picked 9 videos. I had these compilation DVDs. I picked 9 videos, put them in chronological order, and just started telling stories. And the people... the 400 fans and all the comics and all the agents and all the managers flipped, absolutely flipped. And they all said, you've got to do this. You've got to tour this. And I thought, well, it'd be nice for the fans. That would be nice. But God, you know, I want to find my own voice. And I don't know if I want to go around and tell family stories. And you know, there was just kind of the psychological part of all of it. My dad dying and me trying to.
I mean, is it an issue for you in your life that you're defined in some way by being his daughter and just not your own person? Are you okay with that now? Was ever that an issue for you? I mean, my father put floors in for a living, so I never get introduced. But the son, Paul Mercurio, hey. You might know him better as the son of the floor covering guy, Arthur Mercurio.
Hey, if you were at a floor convention, I'm telling you, you'd be that kid. Yeah. You know, for years, it did bother me, and I did have to go away from it for a while and really separate myself, and that's when I went and I got my master's degree in psychology and really created a separate life and a separate identity for myself. And that was important. And it is important.
Was your dad able to help you in that regard, sort of get out from under his shadow? Or is that just not something a person in that position can really do to help
you? No, it's really up to me. It was up to me to make that choice. I mean, I grew up here in L.A. with, you know, going to high school with lots of kids of famous people, and so I watched, you know, the full spectrum of how people dealt with that. Some people dealt with it very well, some people did not deal with it at all, and you know just it's crashed and burned, and you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And really what I've come to, and after my dad died, what I came to was, A, I'm an only child, his legacy is important to me. I think his work is essential for the planet, so I want to make sure his legacy stays alive. So that's part of it. That's part of my task in life is to do that. But also my task is to do my work, my artistic work, or whatever work I want to do in the world.
Right.
And also, you know, I fully embrace that he's my father. And at the same time, I know I'm a complete and total individual and am not defined by him. And and that's really the key, is learning how to not be defined. But this goes for anybody out there. I mean, all of us.
Right.
Learning how to not be defined by our parents, by our education, and by our culture. You know, that's the essential purpose of being an adult, I believe. So I mean, that's kind of where I'm at right now. So when, you know, I didn't want to do this solo show to begin with, but then I was resistant to it. I thought, you know, I should really go off and do something else first. But Paul Provenza, who's also become a dear friend of mine.
Oh, he's a good friend of mine. This is crazy. He's a very, very good friend of mine. And he also did my show. He's a great guy.
He's a
purist when it comes to, he's somebody, when I think of your dad, I think of him in that mold of your dad in a way.
Yes, very much a purist. And he and I became friends, and I was working on The Green Room, and he said to me, he loved the idea of this solo show because he knew it could be something more than just a famous kid's daughter doing a show about her father. And he got it as much as I did. And he said, you know, if you want to do this, Kelly, I would love to collaborate with you and direct this. Mm. And when he said that to me, and like you said, knowing what a purist he is, and what a true just champion of comedy, but also he's also a stage actor. Mm. You know, he's got major chops in many different ways.
Oh, he was great. He was the lead in Steve Martin's play.
Yes.
That Steve Martin wrote, and is a really, really good actor. A lot of people don't realize that.
I saw him in that play. I didn't even know who he was a million years ago, which is so funny.
Yeah.
And yes, and he, I then knew, okay, this could be a real theatrical, interesting art piece. Mm-hmm. And that's what he and I aimed for. And that's what we've developed. And, so it's been a, just such an incredible pleasure and ride and education.
And where are you performing? Are you currently performing it? Can people see it?
I have not been performing all year because I've been working on this book. But in February, I'm doing a 5-week run at the Falcon Theater here in Los Angeles. It's Gary Marshall's theater. They're producing it for a 5-week run. I've been doing comedy festivals for the last 3 years with it, and South by Southwest, and some one-offs. I went to New York last fall and was in a solo show festival, which was amazing. So I haven't done a full run of it yet. So Paul and I are very excited to shape it in a way that's, it's really, really theatrical. You know, we're looking to do, you know, kind of like, you know, the Billy Crystal, you know, that kind of level of a thing, to bring it up to a real theatrical level, by, you know, being able to do it at, the Falcon Theater. We're very, very excited about it. So that's the focus.
Is it a multimedia thing? Are you showing clips of your dad?
Yes. Yeah. We start with, just the show opens with my dad talking about kids and how raising a kid is no big deal. All you do is you leave him out in a corner for a few days. And if they're still there, you got yourself a stupid fucking kid. And then I walk out and I look at the audience and I say, yes, I'm his kid.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's,
so we,
that's
we,
great.
Yeah, we play around with the video. We use it to not only highlight where he's at in his career, but we also use it to juxtapose or to underline stories that I've just told on stage. So you've got the persona George Carlin, which is part of what we're playing with in the show, is public versus private. The persona of George Carlin that everyone knows on stage, and not a lot of people know about him privately because he didn't talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
And then I come forward and I tell the stories from my perspective of being a kid, you know, watching my parents, you know, work through him being on the road and their own stuff with drug and alcohol. And then
a couple of the bigger things that you reveal about him, about in his private life, that, you know, the common average person wouldn't know or expect, about him. I'm really fascinated by that.
I don't think there's any facts that I really reveal. I mean, my dad talked in his memoir, which, you know, Last Words, which we posthumously published after he died posthumously.
Right.
Hello. But really the thing I think I reveal the most in my show and certainly in my book is the man, the human. You know, we're all human. We're none of us are perfect. And one of the things that fame does for you, and especially I think my father in particular, because he came off as such an authority figure, which is funny because he had such issues with authority figures.
Right.
That he is the truth teller.
Right.
And the reality is that in a dysfunctional family, truth is a slippery thing. And denial was a dance that our family did very well with lots of different subjects.
Was it in terms of the use of drugs? Or
certainly my mother was an alcoholic. And, you know, my parents, I think, were in denial about how the depth of her alcoholism and the effect it had on me as an only child and being a kid alone, trying to deal with it with two parents that were pretty fucked up for a while.
Yeah. Cause your dad had issues with cocaine and then later pills and booze. And, you know, supposedly there was somebody that, was it Rankin that sort of worked with him, and there was so much cocaine around that he relapsed because there was so much cocaine that your dad had around at the time and all of that kind of thing. And
I believe so. Yes. I don't really know Kenny's story so well, but, during the 70s, dad and was killing himself with cocaine, and my mom was killing herself with alcohol and cocaine. And
right. For people out there who don't know, Kenny Rankin was a musician that was opening for your dad and touring a lot in the, you know, the heyday when your dad was really, you know, had a private jet and was pounding the road hard.
Yes.
You know, that was the culture. It was the late 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
And everybody was drugging and especially artists and stuff. And so how did you cope with the with sort of having a couple of parents that were in and out of your life, so to speak, in terms of, you know, their addictions and abuse, and your dad's on the road a lot. Like, what did that do to you? Did you have an aunt or an uncle that kind of took you under their wing, or how did
no,
you?
No, I became an adult. I became the parent. I became the good girl. I became, you know, the one who needs to be perfect and have everything together, and or at least on the outside look like I had everything together. You know, people at school had no idea what was going on in my house. I came to school and I did well, and I, you know, was the smart one and bright and funny and all of that. And at home, I wasn't sure if my parents were going to be awake or alive when I got home most days, especially during the darkest 2 years.
Were you able to just say, hey, what the fuck, man? Can you like sit? Were you able to sit? I don't know how old were you at this time? Like, you were a teenager?
I was. My mom got sober when I was 11, 12.
Oh, so it's hard to confront your parents at that age.
I was like age 7 through 12, you know, when it really kind of ramped up and got bad. And I did a couple of times, though. I mean, I tell a story in my show. It's a famous story that my dad also told in his book, where we were in Hawaii. And I was, I think it was like 73, 74, I think it was, 70. Anyway, so I'm about 9 or 10, and my parents have been arguing, which they did a lot, those two. There was like 2 years where they just yelled at each other the whole time. And
what were they arguing about?
Everything from, you know, my dad screwing around on the road, probably, and mom drinking, and who's got the coke, and you're keeping it from me. And that was always a big argument, is you have my stash and I have yours, and whose stash is where. And we're in Maui, and so my parents have been arguing for 2 days about my dad's got blow and he's hiding it from my mom and she wants some and he's denying it. And so finally, like, knives come out. I don't know. They've like grabbed the kitchen knives or something. And I absolutely, completely flip out. I finally like hit my rock bottom and just tell them, like, I can't do this anymore. You people are crazy and this is so unfair. And I just have a complete meltdown. And of course, that stops them in their tracks, thankfully.
Yeah.
And I end up writing out a UN style peace treaty. That's,
and you're how old at this point?
I'm about 10 years old.
Oh my God.
And the peace treaty says, I, George Carlin / Brenda Carlin, will not drink alcohol or snort cocaine for the rest of this vacation. You know, I mean, I just write all this stuff out. I write out the little X's with the lines underneath it. They sign it. And things are okay for a little while. Things are calm. And then dad goes into the bathroom, like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes later, locks the door. And mom immediately starts pounding on it and says, you know, you've got blow in there. I know you do. And fuck you. Blah, 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 blah. And she goes marching down to the bar to get a drink. And that was, you know, that's how long that lasted. So, yeah, that was, you know, part like that's what I tried to do. I tried to manage their chaos. You know,
she died of liver cancer. Was that attributed to all of her abuse of alcohol?
She had hepatitis C and and she'd had breast cancer 14 years before that. But yeah, it was liver cancer. It was nasty, aggressive. And
she's a Dayton, Ohio girl. They met in Dayton, Ohio.
In 1960. I tell the story in the show. It's very, very charming.
Was the alcoholism for her? If she had not married your dad and, let's say, married an accountant from Dayton who wasn't the party guy,
she would have been an alcoholic. She was already drinking heavy when she met my dad. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. She was 21 and she was working at a nightclub.
Oh, there you go. So she knew her way around the bottle, let's say.
She did. She did. Yeah. As I say in the show, she was friends with Cutty Sark.
So you're 10 and you're basically having to be the adult in the relationship. Between your parents. I mean, so when does this sort of start to turn to some level of functionality in the family?
My mom got sober when I was 12. Thankfully, she was almost dead. She was down to 87 pounds, and she almost died. Yeah, it was pretty scary. And she got sober, and she was transformed by her sobriety. She just, you know, became the woman and the mom that she always was in her sober moments, but you know, alcohol really changes people. So that created some stability in my life, but kind of the damage, you know, it's a tough thing to be an only child in that situation, and the emotional toll it takes on you, and you know, the kind of anxiety issues. I ended up having a lot of anxiety issues, and but there was at least stability. I mean, my parents were together until my mom died in 97. So they're, you know, they loved each other. I know they had a lot of baggage, and a, you know, a 30 some odd year marriage is a tough thing, but they loved each other, and they were, you know, partners and deeply committed to each other, and very sweet with each other, but kind of had separate lives. I mean, my dad was a workaholic too. I mean, that was the other issue, was that I think my mom drank a little bit because she was bored and felt.
And what was driving him to be such a workaholic? I mean, you know, he, because it's funny, people don't realize how hard stand-ups work at being stand-ups, let alone great stand-ups, and how much is involved. I think they think, you know, you smoke some weed, you get up like 2 in the afternoon, you throw a couple of jokes together, then you party all night, watch some porn, go to a strip club, and do it all again. What was driving that? He had always been that way?
Yes.
Or did he sort of, what was that all about?
You know, from a psychological perspective, I mean, he didn't have a father. Mm. Patrick, his brother, was the black sheep. It was two of them. Mm. And his mom decided that my dad was going to be the chosen one. And Patrick was, you know, kind of reflected on her ex, who was a fall down violent drunk. Mm-hmm. So she decided that you come from that side of the family and George comes from my side, the pure side, you know, and they're both very bright, bright, smart, funny people. But my dad, you know, was very motivated, very young. He, you know, he saw Danny Kaye and people like that in the business, and he knew he wanted to be that one day. I mean,
it's interesting. Your mother had a sort of yin and yang effect on your dad, in the sense that my understanding is that, from what I've read, that he picked up his appreciation of language from your mother, but there was also a lot of headbutting with her and a difficult relationship to the point where he would run away from home occasionally.
Oh, yeah. Mary was a complete control freak. And
so she was trying to make the perfect boy?
She was trying to make the perfect boy, and she wanted him to become a businessman. And here they are, you know, they're growing up on the streets of what they call Irish Harlem, you know, and they're
122nd Street.
Yeah. West 121st. And, you know, tough neighborhood. And mm-hmm. But Mary worked as an executive secretary for the Hearst Corporation, mm-hmm. high up in the corporation. And, you know, and she'd always had high aspirations. And her husband, my dad's dad, made a lot of money as an advertising salesman. So, you know, she wanted the good life, and she wanted her sons to have it, too. And so she wanted to shape my dad into becoming a great businessman, and my dad would have none of it. You know, he knew where he was. He bristled at authority. He bristled at school, but he was brilliant.
When did that start for him? You know, there's a great quote of his from Your Old Disease, which is, "I've always been willing to put myself at great personal risk for the sake of entertainment, and I've always been willing to put you at great personal risk for the same reason." That's not something you write as a comedic line. That's something that's in your DNA. And where does this passion for performing come from him? And how young are we talking about?
Young. He was doing stand up on the stoops. He was doing imitations, yes, of everybody in the neighborhood.
I just had Bobcat Goldthwait on my show. We're actually filming my podcast as a TV show now, and we had him as a guest. And was seven. 7 years old, homesick, and guess what happened to him one day? On the TV was a guy named George Carlin doing a routine, and he said, "I was mesmerized." And he said, when it was done, I turned to my mother. I said, "Ma, what does that guy do?" She said, "Well, that's what he does." And he goes, "He gets paid to do that?"
Wow.
She said, yeah. He goes, "Wow, that's a great scam." And he became obsessed with your dad, and then Bill Cosby, and then Andy Kaufman and Steve Martin. And it was at 7 years old,
wow,
seeing your dad, that he thought, "This is kind of my thing." And
yeah.
I think you're either born with that or you're not born with that.
Yeah, you know? I think you know that you're an entertainer. I mean, you know, my dad tells the story of being in the movies and watching Danny Kaye and deciding right there and then, okay, first I'll become a DJ. And then I'll become a stand-up, and then I'll become like Danny Kaye. You know, that was his path, and he
started to pursue that. I mean, he went into the Air Force, discharged early, shockingly, a non-judicial punishment, court-martialed three times. What did he do to get court-martialed three times?
I don't know. I think he called one of the officers and I don't know, he called him a name and he fell asleep on guard duty. And...
Okay, so this is where the disconnect is for me, okay? Because, you know, in researching your dad more and you, you start to realize, okay, this guy's clearly counterculture. But part of you goes, okay, well, it's from when he's a kid. But then you think, well, maybe it's not when he's a kid. Maybe it was after the Air Force.
No.
Because who in their right mind, if they're counterculture, would go into, of all places, the service? Like, because, why did he do that?
Because he didn't finish high school. You have to have some sort
right,
of a plan.
Right, he left Cardinal Hayes or was asked to leave, involuntarily,
He didn't finish high school. And, I mean, you know, if you read his book, I mean, he explains all of this for himself. I don't know the exact details of all of his life. I'm not in charge of that. But, yeah. But I mean... It was a path. This is the 50s. You have to have a path. And I think he really believed, I don't know how he got the DJ thing in his head with the Air Force thing, but it worked. I mean, he was down in Shreveport and became a DJ down there, and the Air Force guys let him do it because they thought it was, you know, good for their reputation in the city. And having an officer on the thing was a great idea and all of that. And so it worked for a while until
he got... That's where he met his comedy partner, Jack Burns. And then they moved to L.A. Briefly.
They moved to L.A. And yeah, I mean, he had a lot of success right away. I mean, he was very talented and people noticed that. And it was of an era when, you know, bright, smart comedy guys were coming of age, you know, and so he played the game. Those first, you know, 10 years or 9 years till 1969, he played the game completely. And, you know, and he
what do you mean by playing the game? That was that whole like corporate look, short hair.
Yeah, he wanted to do the right TV shows and get on the right bills and the right theaters. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was in the coffee houses in the village doing other material, but he knew he wasn't going to get a career and make money. And he wanted to get to the movies. He really thought that's what he wanted
the vision of being Danny Kaye.
Yeah. And he thought then he could have freedom and it would satisfaction and fulfillment. And then when we came out to LA in 66 and he started doing TV and got some films, he realized, oh, this is not what he thought it would be.
That's so unbelievable because that's the same thing that happened to Bobcat Goldthwait. You know, he had big success in the 80s with, you know, Police Academy movies. And
yeah.
He goes, I was getting more and more angry, you know, to the point where he lit the Tonight Show set on fire. And he talks about why he did that. And one of the reasons was I was just kind of bored and I was trying to mix it up. But I was also angry. And he goes, I thought I was happy with what I was supposed to get, and I got it, and I wasn't happy, and what do I do now? And now he's very happy. He's doing directing and writing indie films, and he says I'm in the happiest place I've been in, but it took me 28 years to get there.
Well,
and so,
of course. I mean, I think it's the typical American dream story the middle age crisis story.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not a crisis. I think it's just, it's an awakening, and it's an important awakening for people. And some people are lucky enough to walk away from the thing that's killing them and to try something different and to be talented enough and have enough luck to hit with that too. I mean,
right.
My dad was very lucky. He got to evolve into, you know, he took a huge leap. We had, my mother had just put a deposit down on a house in the San Fernando Valley. My dad had a $12,000 a week contract in Las Vegas. And that was huge in 1969. I mean, my dad had made it and we were going to be living the life here in LA.
Yeah, because at that point he had done the Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
Oh, no, he was beyond that. He was, it was 1969 now. He was at the top of his game. He was, you know, the big thing, and Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas, and you know, he was doing everyone's shows, and and he was miserable, absolutely miserable, and he got fired from Vegas, and he knew then and there that he just couldn't do it anymore. He'd been miserable for about 3 years.
Why was he miserable? What was it about it that
because
didn't
he couldn't speak the truth? He couldn't speak the truth. He had to do the bullshit, you know, he had to do the hippie dippy weatherman every time he went on. He had to do the Indian sergeant every time he went on. He had to do these middle of the road acts. He had to do the audiences that he was doing in clubs were the parents of the people he wanted to be talking to. He wanted to be speaking truth to power, and his audience members were the power, were the elite, and he could not, I mean, he couldn't say the word ass or shit on stage.
So was he living, you made some allusion to this a minute ago, was he on the side or sort of secretly doing these coffee houses where he could let that part of himself He was off stage.
He was hanging out with counterculture people. He was hanging out with musicians. He was hanging out with counterculture comics. Early in the 60s, he was down at the, you know, he was down at the Bitter End. He was down at the clubs. Mm. He would go to those clubs. He would, you know, he would, but he, that was not how, what his bread and butter was. Mm. So he was living a dual.
He was performing that at those clubs occasionally.
He could get on stage and he could be looser and he could talk about smoking weed. And I mean, he was a hippie. He was a counterculture man in a suit with short hair and straight. And it was killing him. He was living a lie, a complete and total lie, and it was killing him, and he couldn't do it anymore. And he looked at my mother and he said, I can't do this anymore. I have to do it differently. And we gave it all up. We gave up the house, we gave up all the stuff, and we moved into a small apartment in Venice Beach, and my dad grew his hair out and his beard and started writing new material. And within 3 years, he had FMAM, Class Clown, and Occupation Fool out, and this explosion of expression came out of him because he'd been holding back all this material for years.
It's a really amazing thing because it's a scary, scary thing to do. Like, you know, there are times for me, like, you know, I don't think I'm doing, you know, I'm not your dad, obviously, but I feel like, you know, there are times when you're sort of doing stuff and, you know, especially on the road and you're in Dayton, Ohio, and you're headlining, and you kind of know that that audience is going to go for a certain thing and you really want to talk about something else, and you do it and it fails and it's disappointing, or you don't do it and then you're disappointed in yourself for not trying.
Yes.
And it is a pull between art and commerce, you know. And you do I mean, look, I could make the argument that, and I can't speak for your dad and I can't speak for Bobcat, but if it had been flipped and there was no 9-10 years of crazy success, mainstream success that your dad had, and he started out in coffee houses and basically spent the rest of his life in coffee houses without a big houses and private jets and everything else, would he have been happy?
Who knows? That's
the thing. It's
that's not how it happened, you know?
Yeah.
And I think knowing what you don't want is really important. And the only way you can find that out is by just doing something. You know, people always want to sit in their houses and figure out what's their next move, or, you know, in the entertainment industry. I did this for two decades of my life. What am I going to do? Am I going to be a writer? Am I a performer? Am I a director? What do I want to do? Da, da, da. Yeah. I just talked about it in my head and I never went out and did it. And until you go out and do something, you're not going to know if it fits or not. And you're not going to know how to adjust. And you have to take the risk that it's not going to work, and that you absolutely will have to reinvent yourself. I mean, that's just the way life is. Life is not a straight line.
People
think
it is. I mean, that's what happened to me. I mean, I was on Wall Street and I thought I had, and then, you know, I was doing M&A deals
exactly.
and making a lot of money. And
yes.
It's so weird when you talk about your dad and your mom selling their house. I had a 2-bedroom co-op doorman building on the Upper West Side, 50 feet from the Museum of Natural History. I sold it. I sold everything that I owned and I moved to a rooming house in New Rochelle, just outside the city. I was paying $320 a month. It was a little 10 by 12 room with a hot pot on the floor. And it was literally like, you know, those old film noir movies where you go to see, they go visit the bad guy, you know,
yes.
And he lives in this like disgusting house. That's what this was. And we shared a bathroom and a kitchen with each other. And my neighbors were two ex-cons, two recovering addicts, and a 300-pound phone sex operator who sold Herbalife diet products door to door.
That's awesome. It's beautiful.
And then I had to tear everything down and start from the bottom up, working shit gigs and hell gigs, and going 2 hours up into Connecticut to get stiffed $50 on a bar gig, and just was by people who would not have been allowed the responsibility of Xeroxing our documents on Wall Street, who now had power over me. And what am I done? Is this the right thing? But ultimately, you know, it picked me. I didn't pick it. And I thought for a long time I was picking it. But I don't think, you know what I mean? It's not something that you have a control over. But I agree.
I mean, I went to grad school in 2001 to get my master's in psychology just because I wanted to just, get away from the business and just find more a depth to myself and really understand the human journey. I knew I wanted to like take this information. It was like Jungian stuff and Joseph Campbell and mythology and really cool kind of juicy California stuff. But I love that stuff. And I really wanted to feed myself on a different level outside of, you know, doing a solo show because I'm going to get a sitcom, you know, like that never worked for me either. And so I too, you know, even growing up, you know, with my dad, struggled with this art versus commerce thing. I mean, I think everyone in this business does, because you want a certain amount of success because you do want an audience. You do want to make a dent. You do want to pay the rent, but at the same time, you don't want to have to sell your soul for it. And so when, you know, leaving and getting my master's was kind of an important time for me to reassess who I was. And then when I came out of that, I could really make the decision. Do I really want to step back into this business, and how do I want to do it? And even after my dad dying, I mean, you know, I got thrown into and accepted it too, the role of being his voice and representing him in the world, which is fine because I adore him and adore his work and adore his fans and understand what an impact he's had. And I think it's really important. But I also made the decision of, okay, I think I'm ready to go for it. And Paul Provenza really helped me with that when I was doing my solo show. He looked at me and he said, you know, Kelly, you can't stand one leg out and one leg in with this thing. You've got to go all in and really commit. And that day I did. I looked at him and I said, I'm ready to commit. And since then, I'm here, you know, and I'm committed. And
good for you.
And, you know,
I mean, was part of the hesitation to be able to, you know, commit to something or to get out of the sitting in your chair and thinking about these ideas of what you want to do but not acting, because you're George Carlin's daughter and it's just like it's got to be the perfect right thing because you're going to be judged, not as a stand-up obviously, but just I think it's got to be harder for you because the minute you put your name on something,
yes,
there's this instant sort of like, oh
yes,
okay. Yeah. And so I, knowing me, I'd be like, oh, it's got to be the perfect right thing. No, they'll say something. No, they won't like that. No. And I would be frozen. I would do the same thing.
And yeah, for sure. For sure. The shadow is big. And you know, the eyes are on you. And, you know, and I had the option, too, of using another name. I could use my married name and come in under the radar. But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't feel like that's my destiny or my fate. Like there's something about me having to deal with this name, to deal with this shadow, to step through it and to be willing to be in it and not of it at the same time I really feel like is part of my personal path in all of this. And
Well, it's funny. Your dad had a quote that I really liked that I pulled, which is apt to this part of the conversation, which is take a fucking chance. Put a little fun in your life. Most Americans are soft and frightened and unimaginative, and they don't realize there's such a thing as dangerous fun, and they certainly don't recognize a good show when they see one.
Yeah, and that's dad definitely being stage a bit hyperbolic on stage. Yeah. You know, he loved to pump up the rhetoric with that kind of stuff, and, you know, I mean, that was part of his thing, you know. But he could have used some of that advice. He worked too much.
Were you able to get him to pull back like later in life? I mean, he did 14 HBO specials.
He was a workaholic. He was on the road a lot, you know, partly because he owed the IRS a lot of money for a long time, but also because he loved his work. He was passionate about his work. And, you know, I mean, his typical thing would be like, I'd say, you know, we'd have my husband and I have these really beautiful big Thanksgiving dinners. And and I'd say, Dad, you know, and Sally, when my mom, it's after my mom died, I'm like, you know, you guys come over like 4, we're hanging out for a few hours and we'll sit at 5:30 and then we'll eat. Da, da, da. And Dad'd be like, OK, so we're going to come over, but I don't think we're going to come at 4. We're probably just going to come. OK, I think we're just going to come for dessert. We're just going to come and have some pie. I'm like, okay, Dad, whatever you know, whatever you feel comfortable with or whatever, you know, because he always claimed his sitting around socializing, whatever, is awkward for me. He's kind of an introvert in some ways. So then he'd call back and go, okay, so no, we're going to come for dinner. And we're going to come for the whole dinner. I'm like, okay, that's great. Whatever you want, Ted. So he would end up coming, spending 4 hours there. As he's walking out the door, he would look at me and go, God, this is great. We should do this more often. And I look at him and I'd say, yeah, Dad, yeah, we try to get you out to do that. But, you know, you don't, you know, it was just so human and so lovely, you know? And
I would think some of that motivation to constantly work and be successful is, I don't want to be amateur psychologist and you're the one with the degree in the area, so you tell me if I'm wrong, but like, my mother's very like never good enough kind of woman, and so maybe there's a little bit of him constantly sort of trying to prove something to his mom, like he's going to be the success that she wanted him to be, but on his own terms, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, definitely perfectionism in there, and I think he would talk about that. For sure, a level of, you know, I mean, that's why he did his work the way he did it. That's why, especially the last, I think, you know, 15 years of those HBO shows, there's a level of conciseness and rehearsal, and every word is rehearsed and written and perfect. And yeah, he was very driven. He was slightly OCD, mm-hmm. and, you know, and definitely, you know, very organized with his work and worked a lot of hours every day and driven. And I think part of it too was, you know, his mortality. He had
three heart attacks.
He had heart attacks and he had, work on his heart done and angioplasties. And, you know, he knew he was lucky to be alive throughout his 60s. And, you know, and after he died, the cardiologist said to me, you know, a man who has his first heart attack in his 40s usually doesn't make it to 70. So it was pretty much a miraculous thing that he did. And that, you know, was like, wow, you know, I knew he was always on the edge of things, but I think he knew that, you know, time was of the essence. And he was just prolific. He's just, his mind did not shut off.
Well, he talks about like, you know, he had that vision for a movie career, and then he had his own television show in 95, which I remember and I really enjoyed, and used the name O'Grady as an homage to his family name, from what I understand.
Yes.
And what turned him off about the movie career? It just felt fake to him, like the kind of material he had to do.
Well, he talks about it in the book, just about having to hit marks and be in the light and, you know, speak other people's words. It just was awkward for him. He wasn't good at it. He was horrible. And you watch him in That Girl and those. I watched Car Wash the other night. It was just embarrassing. He got better at it as he got older. Yeah. He had some great roles, you know, Prince of Tides and Jersey Girl. I thought he did beautiful work in. But he's not a man who wants, you know, he didn't know how to immerse himself in a character too much, you know, without being over the top. And he learned, you know, character stuff in a different direction. So that was, he wasn't a trained actor like Robin Williams.
It's interesting because there's a silver lining in things, because you mentioned that he had a lot of IRS debt, and he talks about, you know, in 2001 in an Esquire article, he talked about sort of, you know, the other reason he turned his back on the movie career was he just needed to go on the road and make a lot of money to pay down the IRS debt. And he said it was actually was probably the best thing that ever happened to him, because he said I'm quoting him, it made me a way better comedian.
Yes.
Because I had to stay on the road. I became a really good comic and a really good writer. And, it's interesting because his themes kind of covered three areas, as he described them: the little world, observational humor, the big world, and then, you know, sort of, the peculiarities of the English language, and then humanity's bullshit. And do you find any of that sort of, for you now as a performer, as a writer, how much of that is rubbed off on you? Do you have his sort of...
all of it. Love of language, always. Yeah. He and I had shared that a lot. And I feel I am blessed with this Carlin perspective that both my dad and my uncle have also, that of being able to see the world from an interesting angle and, to be able to stand outside of it and observe the patterns of the world to comment upon it. And, I do that somewhat in my solo show and my book. I mean, those are more personal stories, but I've really gotten a chance to investigate and to express that more. I have a podcast called Waking from the American Dream that I do. It's on Smodcast, and I haven't been doing it lately, but with the book. But That's where I really have fun talking about big broads. I have all sorts of people on the show, authors, comedians, Zen Buddhist masters, all sorts of things. And that's where I really love talking about, you know, what's happening on the planet and doing it and seeing it from an interesting perspective. So
do you think you're, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but your dad could be cynical early on. And I think later in life, just as an observer and a huge fan, maybe became a little bit more cynical about, and I believe it's probably from a place that, you know, you want to love humanity, but they keep letting you down.
Yeah, that's what I told him. I said, you know, if you didn't care, you wouldn't be up there on stage every night.
Yeah,
Dad.
I mean, so,
and he took that in, and he said, yeah, I get it. And he says, definitely, he was a brokenhearted idealist. I mean, for sure.
Do you think he became? It seemed like in the last couple of specials that it was a little bit more sort of cynical and sort of disappointed.
I wouldn't use the word cynical because I think a cynic is a person who doesn't believe in something, or he wouldn't describe himself as cynical. He described himself as a person who just saw the systems, the patterns, and felt that it wasn't going well, and that when it came to individuals, it's a different story, but as a species, we're not doing well. And he just spoke the truth about that, and it felt cynical and it felt harsh and angry, and sometimes it was, and it made me uncomfortable and I didn't agree with it, but other times you couldn't deny the truth of it. And I think it's important to have both. I think it's important to learn how to let go of hope completely, because I think there's something through the other side of hope that is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to wake up in the morning and believe in something. And he believed in his work, and he believed in observing, and that he believed in making people laugh. That's what kept him going. And he also believed in, you know, his love with Sally and his friendships and, you know, his connection to his brother and myself and, you know, the small joys in life of the day. But
yeah,
you know,
4-hour Thanksgiving dinners, he seemed to like that.
He seemed to learn to like that.
Yeah. Did Lenny Bruce have a big impact on that? I know he was there when Lenny got arrested.
Lenny gave my dad his first manager. So yeah, Lenny changed, you know, Lenny was my dad's hero.
Yeah. And sort of encouraged him to pursue that voice inside of him that said, you really got to go this other way.
I knew he was funny. And well, Lenny wasn't around when my dad went the other way, but Lenny had already died. But but Lenny saw a real spark in my dad and encouraged him. And that meant the world to my dad.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So where are you? The book is being written and
I'm almost
done. You have the healthy sort of view of life, and you're continuing your dad's sort of work in that way. But you've got your own path that you're following.
Yep.
And you're doing the show, and you're doing the book, and you're doing your own radio show on Sirius XM, as we mentioned. And so in the long term for you, where do you see yourself continuing to perform after this show is?
Yeah, I love, hey, you know, getting a laugh. And you know, getting on stage with the show has taught me how to be on stage. I've learned to breathe and live and we'll learn even more in this 5-week run, certainly. And
don't get scared in the silences.
Yeah, no, the silences are powerful for me because that's where I work. The silences don't scare me because I'm not a person trying to generate laughs. I love getting a laugh, but it's not what it's about for me. Truth and depth is important to me. I don't know. My book will come out next year. I'm guessing I'll be touring the show during that time. I'm taking it one day at a time and being present with what feels right. And when it doesn't feel right, I'll move on. I love doing interview stuff. I love to do more public speaking in general without being a performer. Right. That kind of stuff is interesting to me. Would love to have a TV show like The View. Would love to do something like that. So, you know, who knows? But I'm just present and, you know, what comes along, I check it out with my innards and say, does this feel right? Yes, no, yes, no. And move forward. So,
I'm sure it's going to be great. If you could write a treaty for your parents at the age of 10, you can do anything.
Thank you.
You're my kind of gal, as they say, as the old guys would say.
Yeah,
you're my kind of gal.
That's right. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Well, we gotta, when you get the, when the book's out, you gotta come on again, and we'll get you on, and we'll talk about the book a little bit more.
That'd be great. Yeah, next fall, 2015. Oh my God, a year from now.
Oh God. do you have kids yourself?
I don't. No.
Okay.
I have a dog.
Yeah. My son's an only child, so I'm curious as to how that's going to play out for him. He seems to be okay.
Yeah,
we're not going at each other with knives right now, but we do argue.
It's a unique experience, as it is having brothers and sisters. So
yeah.
Who knows?
Well, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on. I hope you enjoyed it.
And I did.
We've got the run of the show coming up in February, and where is that going to be again?
It's Falcon Theater here in LA in Burbank.
Okay, and then Sirius XM 24/7 Carlin Channel. Carlin's Corner on channel 600, and you're on Raw Dog at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And your next guest is going to be Fred Willard. So
yeah,
people should be checking that out.
This Sunday, the first Sunday of the month, is me and Fred Willard. It's a great conversation. He's such
a
doll.
Well, thanks for being on the show. I love talking to you, and we'll talk to you again. And everybody, thanks for listening. This has been the Paul Mercurio Show, and my very special guest, Kelly Carlin, who is just doing some really cool stuff. And you're going to see her on her own show called The View. And I'm going to be on it. No, I don't know. All right. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right. So that was Kelly Carlin. How cool was that? What a life she's led. And what an interesting family. To say the least, how cool is it that at 10 years old, she's drafting up a treaty so that her parents could stop going at each other with knives over cocaine? Kind of makes my Italian family screaming about meatballs seem like Leave It to Beaver. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. I really did. And we're going to be actually talking to George Carlin's brother, Patrick, in the near future, who has got great stories and is a really cool dude in his own right. I hope you enjoyed Kelly. I thought she was fantastic. And keep an eye out for her one-woman show, and definitely tune into her show on Sirius XM. And come see me do stand-up September 4th through the 7th. In Arizona at the Stand Up Live Comedy Club in Phoenix, Arizona, September 4th through the 7th. Beautiful venue, big venue. Come on out, hang out. And over the course of August, I will be in New York City at all the major clubs, Comedy Cellar, Gotham Comedy Club, Comic Strip, Stand Up New York, Cabin, cool alternative room. So please come on out and check me out in New York City. And thanks for checking out the podcast, folks.
Take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.